Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Bernoulli. Today we have Nomi Prinz. She's a renowned journalist, author, and speaker. She's currently working on a new book, Collusion, formerly called Artisans of Money, that will explore the recent rise of the role of central banks in the global financial and economic hierarchy. Her last book, All the President's Bankers, is a groundbreaking narrative about the relationships of presidents to key bankers over the past century and how they impacted domestic and foreign policy. Before becoming a journalist, Nomi worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs, ran the International Analytics Group as a senior managing director at Bear Stearns in London, and worked as a strategist at Lehman Brothers and an analyst at Chase Manhattan Bank. Welcome, Nomi.
Hi, thank you very much, Richard.
Great. I thought today we would focus on a recent writing you have that stems from your emerging book, Collusion. It's titled The Decade of G7 Central Bank Collusion and Counting. It's a great piece. It comes on your website, and it's been reprinted elsewhere as well. And just wondering if you'd like to give a brief synopsis of that.
Yeah, well, that piece, it comes from some of the conclusions that relate to really ongoing monetary policy globally, particularly with the G7 central banks. And when I talk about collusion, in terms of the importance of setting monetary policy to the G7, for the G7, there have been, since the financial crisis in the United States, just so many multiple meetings, background meetings, calls, statements between the central bank leaders and so forth, that collectively have created a monetary policy that is 0% interest rates and has also connected to it a substantial amount of asset buying, or what we now know under the term quantitative easing, by the major central banks in particular. It's not that other central banks haven't been co-opted or have sort of retaliated by setting or trying to set their own monetary policies in their own countries, but it just so happens that this has been a G7 process that has been led by the United States, by the Central Bank of the United States, the Federal Reserve, and in particular the G3 central banks, the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of Japan, that has together kept interest rates at on average 0. On the Fed, of course, this last year and a half have raised rates up to 1%. But while that happened, 19 countries in Europe, including the ECB, have rates at negative, as well as does Japan and the Japanese central bank. So on average, that comes out to 0. And it's not an individual policy. It's a collusive, collaborative policy.
So it's almost like a collective set of G7 central banks is acting as a unified central bank. Could that be stated?
Yeah, no, they're absolutely acting as unified. And occasionally they have independent commentary to their regions, whether that be throughout Europe, whether that be in the UK, whether that be in Japan. But the idea is that even if you take these individual statements and meetings and media coverage separately, the reality is this is a coordinated effort. For example, last year when the Fed had raised rates and it caused a lot of chaos in the markets in the beginning of 2016, immediately, so some of the other major central banks in Europe and Japan cut their rates down, and it was sort of like a balancing act. But the way the coverage works in general is it really tends to be independent. And so what I looked at for the book is all of the communications and collaborations and the timing of all the various monetary moves, which again collectively have us at 0, but that there was a process along the way. There was a process after the financial crisis where the Fed first embarked upon 0% interest rates, so sort of first embarked upon quantitative easing, just simply buying U.S. government bonds, U.S. treasuries, and then very soon after that, U.S. mortgage bonds from the private banks that needed the liquidity, needed the capital. But this sort of grew, and you have the European Central Bank buying corporate bonds, you have the Japanese Central Bank sort of buying collections of equities here and there. So the process, sort of segued into different details. But it was very much coordinated. And over the years, when, for example, there was a problem with debt, there's a problem with debt everywhere right now because there's zero interest rates. So when there was a particular problem, for example, in 2012 in Europe with a potential credit crisis after all of these years of cheap money anyway and the potential for defaults and all of that, that's when, again, central banks got involved and acted in a unified fashion. So throughout the period of the last 10 years since the U.S. financial crisis began, there's always been these iterations of collaboration and them acting as a unit, even though their individual leaders tend to behave within their own countries and to their own governments as if they're acting independently.
Yeah, it almost seems like it's sort of a game of passing the baton, like an Olympic team running event. And because, like, I remember back in 2014, there was a time when the Japanese Central Bank, Bank of Japan, seemed to have taken over the baton, if you will, from the Federal Reserve. And
that's right.
So almost seems like there's when one of the countries gets into trouble, they sort of let that country run with more quantitative easing. Do you see a lot of examples of that?
Yeah, it's actually interesting. If you look at just the chart of the G7 and then hone that into the G3 from the last 10 years, you'll see exactly what you're saying is that in 2014, what happened was it began in 2013, but you saw it more substantially from 2014 on, is the central bank governor in the Bank of Japan, Kuroda, went on this crazy, very fast, accelerated pace of quantitative easing. And so what wound up happening was all of a sudden, the line, if you just look at a chart of the buying, purchasing of JGBs or Japanese government bonds by the central bank just went up almost in a straight line fashion, but certainly, in a very steep line upward. Because two things happened: the president of Japan and the central bank of Japan were in coordination as well within the country. So there was a coordination between letting the Bank of Japan kind of go nuts on quantitative easing, and then it worked within the fiscal policy promises of Abe, of Shinzo Abe, who had just come in as well as the leader of Japan. He wanted to improve the economy. His concept was he had three pillars of an economic policy, one of which was having sort of this cheap money, and then that worked with what the central bank leader wanted to do because he's actually quite international, Kuroda as well, and saw his opportunity to really ratchet up quantitative easing there. And that also had the effect of, accelerating the Japanese stock market, had the effect of accelerating the purchasing, the flattening of the yield curve, the purchasing of government bonds and so forth. And as recently as, a few weeks ago, central bank leader in Japan, Kuroda, was talking about this idea of unlimited capacity to continue to buy bonds or continue the quantitative easing process, which also, so was Mario Draghi in slightly different words, but not too different, was doing in Europe. So it is a passing of the baton, and you would think that after 10 years of what began, according to the Fed anyway, as emergency measures in the wake of the financial crisis, the idea, if we go back then, was that there was no liquidity in the banking system, that there was a fear that was, sort of stoked by the Treasury Secretary then, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, and the Federal Reserve head at the time, Ben Bernanke, and the New York Federal Reserve president, Tim Geithner, who all basically got together and sort of colluded to basically indicate that unless there was this immense amount of liquidity offered to the banking system, everything would seize up, people wouldn't get their money out of ATMs and so forth. And so they created this bailout from the standpoint of Congress, but the bigger bailout was what the Federal Reserve did and what central banks did, which was at the time start to bring rates down to zero at the end of 2008, and then start to buy bonds. And then when the Fed stopped, the European Central Bank started and accelerated, and then the Bank of Japan continued to accelerate. And then the smaller central banks involved in all this, like the Bank of England, has like, you know, half a trillion or so worth of assets on their books. They've kind of dribbled in and out, but recently have talked about expanding their quantitative easing program. Mark Carney there, the head of the central bank there. And they kind of use it as this tool, or they promote it as this tool to either stimulate growth in economies or, you know, create stability, you know, in opposition to some type of a problem or a process. I mean, even when there was a, you know, you had the problem at Fukushima, you had the other, you know, G6 central bank governors get together and promise that they would help with whatever liquidity was needed for Japan to navigate that crisis. So it began as an emergency measure, has become normal, or normalized, I should say.
In the collusion article, you mentioned that the central banks have amassed assets on their books worth nearly $14 trillion. Is that for the big three central banks, or the G7, and
that's exactly right. That's pretty much the G3 are at about, you know, give or take 13.5, and then you add in the UK, and then you sort of add in, you know, Canada, you sort of add in some other banks in there, and it's probably a little bit more than that, but on average it's, you know, between 14 trillion and say 14.2 or 0.3 trillion, but it's a fairly large number. If you consider that number was basically, you know, like zero 10 years ago.
And you mentioned the result of all this is a fueling of bubbles and money that's not serving any productive real economy purpose because it happens to be in lockdown. Can you elaborate on those?
Yeah, so if I'm a central bank and over some period of years, I decide to create electronic money, you know, we refer to it as printing money. That's kind of an old euphemism. But you know, the idea is you're creating some kind of fabrication for money that is then used to exchange in an exchange process for either government bonds, so government debt, or in the case of the U.S., for example, mortgage debt from the banks. What that does is it puts this fabricated money into the system, which, you know, didn't come from tax receipts. It didn't come from organic, you know, growth in companies, big or small. It was merely manufactured, and it was on offer in return for the Fed amassing debt on their books. You know, debt in the form of treasury bonds, debt in the form of mortgage bonds. And so what that means is that it effectively created, you know, just the Fed, $4.5 trillion worth of money that did nothing but an exchange for debt. And if you're just exchanging debt and you can't determine how that debt would have been spent anyway, then it's really just sitting there on the books for no apparent purpose. Now, you know, it's not the Fed's job technically to do this, but if you had example conceived of a process by which instead of exchanging fabricated money for debt, you invested it in some sort of a national bank, or you developed roads with it, or railways, or, you know, better electronical, you know, waves or whatever, or electronic systems or energy systems or whatever it might be, you know, that's productive. You know, solar systems, clean energy, whatever the process is, you know, there could have been productive ways to utilize fabricated money to actually enhance the real economy. But if you're just buying debt and you can't trace that debt to the real economy, and in fact, in particular, for example, with mortgage bonds, all you're really doing is giving banks liquidity or giving them capital to do other things with, because you're not telling them, you know, what they can or cannot do. You're not stipulating what kind of loans they can or cannot make. It's just sort of capital that's given to them. Then that money is not being used for any productive purpose. And it is on lockdown at the Fed because they basically offered it out. They have in exchange received these bonds or this debt, and they're not going anywhere. They're just sitting on the books of the Fed, not being used for any financing of any productive purposes or real growth or wages or hiring people or research and development or really anything. And that's been copied in Europe as well in terms of trillions of dollars on the European Central Bank, in terms of trillions of dollars on the books of the Bank of Japan and so forth. So none of that money is really being used. But the way it gets discussed is that it's somehow connected to economic stimulus. But if it was actually stimulating the economy, then you wouldn't have a 10-year policy where it has to keep continuing. So what you have now after 10 years is the central bank leaders, for example, Mario Draghi at the European Central Bank recently saying, hey, you know what? This is the only thing that needs to be done. Monetary policy alone or, low interest rates and buying bonds alone isn't enough to stimulate the economy. So after 10 years, they're like, we have to keep going, because what we did wasn't enough. And somehow if we keep doing it and other measures get, put into that, whether it's austerity or whether it's other types of fiscal policy, then all together, after we've done this for 10 years, somehow it will relate to the economy. So these people themselves are basically saying that this process, their collusion, their methods, their strategy, their policies haven't really done anything for 10 years.
Yeah, and you even point out how Stan Fisher, who was the vice chair of the Federal Reserve, who recently just stepped down from that role, he essentially admitted that the Fed caused low interest rates globally while failing to achieve that economic growth as promised.
Right. So, and then he quit. And he was Stanley Fisher was the mentor, the academic mentor for the doctorate for both Ben Bernanke and Mario Draghi, who, ran at different times, some overlap, the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank. So it's interesting that Stanley Fisher, who was also, vice chair at the Fed for a number of years before resigning, was one of the supporters of this policy throughout, his years as a mentor, as well as his years of being at the Fed itself. And so he was one of the very people that would have voted, at various meetings and so forth to continue to keep rates low. And the effect of the Fed keeping rates low was that they were kept low globally. Now, what he didn't say was that they were actually kept low globally because they're having communications with each other, and that this was not sort of a choice. It was kind of a mutual decision, and it unfolded that way in terms of events and in terms of when rates were reduced versus, when assets were bought by the various central banks. And then in the end admitted that, this really didn't stimulate growth. And not stimulate growth, which he admitted, but even the Federal Reserve itself had a report out a few years ago where it indicated that after a number of years of these policies in the U.S. anyway, it had actually increased inequality. And the way it does that is because this money that's being created is really only going to, sort of top bankers. It's going, through governments. It's really not trickling down, as we were talking about before, into the real economy, which means it's also being used, cheap money is being used to fuel these bubbles. So if rates are like at zero, on a 2-year or close to zero on a 10-year, depending on the country, government bonds, you're not going to be investing in bonds. You're going to be looking for something else to get returns out of. Now, you have this money coming to you cheaply, but not if you're a regular person. If you're a regular person, you're not getting money at 0% or close to 0% like a bank does. Like a bank can give its major clients, or like major corporations can raise debt for themselves. A regular person is stuck with much higher rates on whether it's personal loans or credit cards or student loans or even mortgages. So they don't have the benefit of the cheap money, yet they suffer the consequences of not having more secure investments like government bonds or even CDs or even good rates on their savings accounts like they would have had historically. So they're sucked into this vortex of the stock market because whether they're actively involved or not, even if it's through their pensions or through their life insurance contracts or whatever it might be, because there's nowhere else for those pools of money to invest and get a return that even keeps up with the very low inflation that we've had globally in the last 10 years because we've had very low growth. So the bubbles are really a result of these policies. And even some of the central banks, the super banks like development banks like the IMF have indicated that this is a problem, that bubbles are a problem. So everybody's aware that these policies don't promote growth, create bubbles in the riskier markets, and yet they have nothing, they can do nothing else but continue them.
So with all of these failed policy experiments behind us, as to what has happened, this brings us to the big question that you ask, why should we have faith that the Fed or any other central bank has any clue about what to do next?
Right. because all they've done for 10 years is effectively the same policy, which they then admit has not gotten them to any closer to what they had indicated initially the policy was supposed to do, which was to stimulate growth. I mean, it's still anemic throughout the G7. In certain actually emergent countries, it's more volatile, but slightly higher. But in terms of real growth, it's not there. In terms of being able to invest in more secure bonds or whatever for the population or for, again, pensions or insurance companies or whatever, you can't do that. And so what are they going to do if there's an actual other crisis? Like what happens if, and a crisis could come in any form. I mean, it could have come from, unfortunately, the hurricane that was, just happened in Florida. And I'm not saying that will create a crisis, but, you have a situation where a lot of development and a lot of real estate and a lot of leverage and a lot of cheap financing going into these larger development companies and through the main banks and so forth, is hit with, a stoppage in occupancy rates or having to rebuild and sort of wait on money coming in, and that trickles into potentially defaulting on certain payments or loans. And I mean, it could be anything that starts to crack these asset bubbles, whether that's a natural, disaster, or whether that's a geopolitical thing, whether it's a new war, or whether it's simply that rates do get raised enough in one area. And I don't believe the Fed's going to raise rates again this year for all these reasons. But to the extent that anything does go up at some point in time, that all these things start to become cracks and let the air out of these bubbles, at which point, what do central banks do? They just, they'll double or triple down on what they have done. And that could work for, more time. It could work for a year. It could work for 2 years. But it's still an artificial stimulant to the global economy. It's still not healthy. It's still an external source of capital that is unlimited, that is, unregulated from the standpoint of a policy, and that's very artificial and creates a lot of ongoing inequality and inability ultimately for people to, to really have money invested in the future and be secure about it.
Given this lessening faith or growing sense of lack of faith in central banks, could we get a sort of a Wile E. Coyote moment in the financial markets where there's this all of a sudden a large drop in the equity markets?
You could, to the extent that something again happens from an external perspective, whether that's a sector continues to default precipitously, and it could be, or something happens to, whether it is a real estate sector, whether it's energy. Right now, energy is going to do a little better because of what just happened. Retail, which has shifted in terms of the way in which people shop, consumers losing confidence. There's a lot of things that can happen external to deflate confidence in what is actually a stock bubble that could have that could drag things down. Now, this policy, these 10 years have been really unprecedented in terms of, this collusion between central banks. If it were not a global policy, it would be more likely that cracks in one area would actually reverberate throughout the world. But because it's collaborative, because it's artificial, and because it's collusive, there's been this way of sort of keeping the house of cards kind of up. But any major thing that happens can also take that down very quickly. I mean, the one thing we learned just studying crises historically, and there's never been a sort of reaction of this magnitude globally to a crisis. But what tends to happen is markets, when something hits, they do tend to go down faster than they went up. That hasn't happened yet, but if there's a confluence of the wrong events, it definitely could.
And if that were to happen, do you foresee the central banks again coming in in a concerted way to save the day, if you will, especially considering that there's a concern on pension funds and insurance companies, you know, with large holdings of equities, and the central banks are not looking forward to bailing them out if there were another financial crisis affecting them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they care so much about pension funds and insurance companies. They care about the financial system as a whole, and I do think that, you know, the first thing that would happen in the event, and this happened in 2016, we sort of a precursor to this, is in the event that something catalyzes a very fast, you know, day or two or whatever fall in the stock market, that the central banks do come in and coordinate some sort of a policy that boosts them up. But the fact is there isn't a lot of give for them to do that this time, simply because they are almost collectively at negative aside from the Fed. I mean, the Fed can go down by the point it's gone up since December 2015, and it can go negative, but there's not much more room to go. It would boost the markets again, though, if things really fell and the Fed said, you know, we're going to buy another $1 trillion, we're going to, you know, reinstate quantitative easing in order to stabilize the economy or stabilize the financial system or, you know, promote growth or whatever it is they'll say that they're doing it for. And so then you'll just have volatility in the markets in that way. You know, you could have like a very steep drop, followed by, you know, the sort of collusive save the day efforts on the part of the major central banks. Then you have like sort of an uptick, and then let's say confidence goes down because there isn't a lot of room to continue to do that or do that in the same magnitude. And then the markets go down again, and you can kind of see, how that might, you know, that might precipitate a sort of jagged type of bear market with you know, major ups in between when central banks do announce movements, which they would announce to try and save the markets. But I mean, all of this just means that their main function has become to continue to keep these asset bubbles inflated. Even in the end, well, a couple months ago when the private banks in the U.S. had to give the results of their stress tests, so basically stressing their books to the extent of what could happen in certain crisis situations. And the Fed said that they all passed with flying colors, having mostly not passed the year before. So somehow in a year, they just managed to magically, you know, change, or the Fed decided they had, or whatever. But that they turned around and said, you know, rather than saving extra capital or whatever, we are going to just buy our own stock. And so now, so that just creates, you know, more inflation of these bubbles. And that's why the financial sector increased by so much more than some of the other sectors, because all of a sudden they were given a green light by their own regulatory body, by the Federal Reserve, by their central bank, to just use this, you know, effectively 1% or less money to buy their own stock and pay themselves dividends that amounted to more than that. So effectively using the Fed's policy to freely inflate their own stock by paying themselves dividends on their own stock that they bought. It's kind of market manipulation if you think about it, but it's legal because the regulatory body that's supposed to jurisdict over this kind of thing greenlighted it.
So where does this all end? You mentioned ongoing emergency procedure spells an eventual recipe for disaster. I guess if you think about growing levels of central bank assets, you mentioned $14 trillion. Given the coming even much higher numbers on unfunded liabilities that, you know, may need to have central banks monetize further debt by governments, but is the endpoint limited by perhaps the interest rate, or you know, sort of if you look at it as a lever between debt and interest rates for servicing debt, is the endpoint at some point involving interest rates?
Well, at some point, what's going to happen is interest rates will continue to remain low. And again, I don't think the Fed's going to move at all this year. The ECB is not going to move. The bank, none of these banks are going to move rates up, you know, for the rest of this year. I mean, that's just definite, or I believe that's definite. But you know, what disaster happens. So not necessarily when and if rates get raised a smidge, although that certainly does push that lever. When the Fed, you know, the fact that the Fed has moved rates by even just 1% has created some more instability in terms of defaults and international corporate defaults and so forth, because you've had companies that have been mostly funded through U.S. banks and other major private banks in dollars because they have multinational operations and they have to repay them in dollars, but their currency isn't worth as much, and the interest rates go up against them, and so they lose twice, and they're not growing as fast, so they don't have much profit to cover it. So that stuff kind of is happening throughout the world sort of organically. And so the lever is really when those numbers start to tip, because at some point, I don't know when this is, I used to try and like find the end point would be like when you know, the European Central Bank actually stops their quantitative easing program. Okay. And then they get to the date where they say, but they get to the date where it was going to stop, and then they extend it, you know, so they have this ongoing elasticity in terms of their policy. But what will happen besides monetary policy and central banks is that the sheer development, the sheer growth of companies that are steep, that are highly, highly leveraged relative to even how they were before the financial crisis, just simply aren't making enough money to cover even the minutest of interest rate payments on their debt. That's when stuff starts to collapse. Not necessarily when rates are raised, although that would certainly hasten it, and that's why it's kind of stopping right now, but when they're actually simply not growing enough organically to make their own payments, and there's a lot of that happening. I mean, we just even look for example, the son-in-law of the President of the United States, so Jared Kushner's companies. He owns he's a real estate person. His major building, for example, 666 Fifth Avenue in New York City, is completely over leveraged, and its occupancy rates continue to get down to become lower, which means he can't pay for even the debt he has with the people that are supposed to be renting out space in his building. That's an organic problem. On the one hand, it's because you've taken on too much debt. On the other hand, it's because other people won't pay you for the provision of your space or your service or whatever, because they don't have the money or don't want to spend that. That's when things start to collapse from a sort of organic perspective. Unless, again, we have a major war, or we have like a major sector or something like that that happens more acutely and that will more quickly create some sort of a collapse.
But not really any idea in terms of the time frame.
Well, you know, if we go back into discussing negativities with North Korea, if the defaults that have been increasing in the various sectors throughout the world continue to increase at a more rapid rate, I mean, you could see a crisis happening within the next year, even though you'll have sort of the cavalry of central banks continuing to double down or triple down on what they've done, simply because there will at that point be nothing on the growth side at all to enable companies, particularly small, medium-sized companies that hire a lot of people, to pay off their debts. And then if they don't hire people, they have to fire people. If they fire people and they're not paying people, people can't buy stuff. If people can't buy stuff, it all goes down very quickly and it becomes a very quick spiral. You're starting to see that. You're starting to see defaults in various sectors, in corporates as a international whole. So if that continues, you could spiral down within the next year, because that will just happen sort of naturally.
Well, that's great insight, Nomi. And how can our listeners learn more about your work? And also, when is your new book, Collusion, coming out?
So Collusion is slated to come out on May 1st of 2018. And, in terms of anyone who wants to read more, you know, whether my books or any writings that I do have online or just in general, you can come to my website, which is just my name. So Nomi Prins, NOMIPRINS.com. And just, you know, sort of check it out.
Great. Thank you very much, Nomi.
Thank you so much, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk. We'll be right back.